I'm Frances Cook. Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. Your career is a huge investment into your financial future, but only if you take control of it. If you want to get the bigger opportunities and the bigger pay that comes with them, you have to get strategic and learn how to negotiate. So, how pushy can you get? Well, let's talk to someone who's been at the top of the financial services industry so we can get the top tips on how to negotiate like a CEO and also how to invest like one. Welcome, Rhiannon McKinnon, founder and CEO of CEO 101. Now, this is not your first time around being a CEO, is it? Because for a long time, you were CEO of KiwiWealth. That's a really big KiwiSaver provider that looked after billions in retirement savings. We'll jump into that soon, that enormous responsibility. But first, were you someone who was always interested in finance? And when did that start?
Good question. I started being interested in finance when I was about 15 years old, but it was only because my older brother, Andrew, who I thought was brilliant, and I listened to everything he said from the age of like nothing onwards. He said to me, Rhiannon, if you want to earn a lot of money, you should go work in the City of London. That's where they all earn lots of money. And I was like, well, I have no idea what I really want to do. I used to be really diligent. I went down to the Careers Centre and used to come home with these like A4 sheets of paper about all these different jobs, and I couldn't work it out. So I thought, well, if I don't know what I want to do, I may as well earn a bit of money while I'm working it out. So I thought, yep, I might head in that direction. And so I actually even sort of chose A-level subjects and from the UK that was sort of vaguely relevant. But then I worked out to get into the City of London, you didn't actually have to do a relevant degree at university. So I just went and read history and sort of then wandered in later.
Well, that sounds really fabulous. When you started to get into the field, it's so interesting to me that you were like, I don't really know what I want to do, so I'm just going to earn a bunch while I figure it out, which is actually, I feel like, pretty smart, really. I don't feel like many people know what they want to do with themselves before they actually experience the career world, because you don't even know what's out there. Once you got there and you were sort of getting your feet under the desk, figuring it out, were you interested? What did you find? Pros and cons?
Yeah, I did find it interesting. I think I went into those one of those graduate programs, so they kind of show you around all this different parts of this investment banking business, and did corporate finance and equity research and fund management and sales and trading. And at the end, they're like, what do you want to do? And you're like, still don't really know. But I ended up doing equity research because it really gave you a real insight into how different companies worked. And you got this chance to kind of meet with the senior management, like the CFOs and CEOs of all these listed companies, who poor things had to kind of talk to me. And I was like 21 years old and really didn't know much about anything, but they had to explain to me how the business was going and, you know, what the future trends were. And with this amazing kind of role with such privilege, you know, I got to learn an enormous amount about how these businesses worked. So it was super interesting. And, you know, I did that for about 5 or 6 years, just sort of learning the ropes about how to value companies and how to sort of think about future trends and how that sort of affects businesses and the economy.
Tell me more about that, because I know a lot of people find that whole world really fascinating. So you started to learn about this is how you figure out what a business is actually worth, which, of course, for anyone interested in investing in shares, that's huge. And you were looking at future trends, what might happen next. Love a little gaze into the crystal ball. Tricky. What are some of your top tips from that time that the rest of us could learn from?
Oh, that's a good one. I think one of the big things about sort of, you know, stocks and shares and how they're valued is it's all about what people think is sort of in the price. So, you know, you might have, and the way that they move is all about those changes and expectations. So say, you know, Tesla, and it's not worth $10, but I'll say it's worth $10. You know, all of it, you know, whether the price, stock price goes up or goes down is all about whether people get more confident about the future or less confident about the future. And, you know, I think one of the funny things is, you know, you can have these incredible results, and people can sometimes post like, you know, we made 20% more money or 100% more money than we did last year. And if it's still less than people were expecting, your stock price still goes down. And I think that's really confusing when you start. Like, that doesn't make sense. You're doing really well. And companies can actually post losses and people go, oh, that was less, you know, less bad than we were expecting. And so the share price goes up. So it is that crystal ball and trying to find, you know, what, you know, it gets really detailed with equity research, but what trends are you seeing and how's that going to be affecting how these companies are going? And can you as an analyst work out before those results come out what's happening? Trends are out there. You know, I used to look at house builders. So you'd look at the housing market, you look at interest rates, you'd try and work out, you know, you'd even kind of sneak around sort of home sales places and work out whether those houses were popular and whether they were selling so that you could get ahead of those trends and try and work out whether those companies were doing better or worse than people already believed.
Yeah, I think that's something that people underrate at the beginning. How far forward the financial industry is looking when it's looking at these companies. They are constantly trying to stay one step ahead of each other, which means they're several steps ahead. I mean, what sort of time horizon were you looking at when you were thinking about what's in a company's plans and how do I value it? Were you trying to guess a year out, 2 years out, more?
Yeah, that's interesting. We normally had about 3 years of like predicted numbers. And then after that, you know, it became very kind of hazy and people, you know, sometimes you had to have 5 years of numbers for your valuation before you got your sort of terminal value. We're getting really kind of financy now. And, you know, there's a whole lot of value in those last, you know, that kind of made up number at the end. But normally about 3 years is what we cared about. And, you know, when the results came out, you would kind of look at, did I get that right? It's almost like a kind of a forecasting game. And, you know, did I get, you know, I said there were going to be 80 million of profits and there was 79, it was 81. You feel pretty chuffed if you hit it on 80. But then it was all about, well, what's going to be next year and how much is that shifting? And that next 1 year to 2 years out, actually, I think is probably where we focused a lot. Probably wrongly. There's a lot of criticism about how quarterly earnings or half yearly earnings makes everyone quite short term in their thinking. And they're always worrying about what those results are looking like rather than thinking about the long term and how to make a really great result for investors with those kind of long term horizons and visions. But people tend to be very like, what's the next quarterly earnings like or what's the next half year? And really, yeah, I would, you know, I was just trying to get my next number right for the next 1 to 2 years.
What about for normal investors, for people who go to a job, they maybe only have KiwiSaver and they maybe have a little bit of investing outside of that? Do people who are trying to build their wealth on the side, but it's not their job and they don't have that much time to dedicate to it, do they need to worry about this stuff? How far ahead should the average person be looking?
That's a really good question. I think you're not going to ever be in those details as a sort of retail investor, or you could, you know, you're very welcome to try and get hold of those analyst reports that are really, really detailed. But I suppose you're going to have to go more on those macro trends and where you think those companies are going. And, you know, one of the fund managers in KiwiWealth used to do that. He would had a sort of, you know, he really went for trends and, you know, what's happening. He used to kind of follow the athleisure trend and start, you know, investing in Lululemon or whatever it might be. Or he started looking at sort of, you know, modern movement and technology, and that takes you towards Uber and those sorts of things. So those kind of macro trends, I think, are easier for a retail investor to take a view on. And then you sort of, then you find the sector and the various companies within it. And then again, you try and say, well, which is the best company within that as well. But you know, that it becomes quite granular. But if you can even just decide which areas of the economy do I think are going to perform better over the next few years, that tends to be quite a good way of going about things.
I really like that. I want to take a step back for a second, because you mentioned about you got into it because your brother, who as an older brother, you thought the sun shone out of him, and then he had this tip. So did your family talk about money much when you were growing up? Was this something that just, you know, was an interest of your brother's and so he passed it along to you? Or was it one of those things where your family talked about money around the dining table, over dinner? You know, how much was money a topic of conversation in your life growing up?
It was a bit, actually. You know, we did. I think my father, every now and again, he would bring up like an important conversation at the dinner table and ask all our opinions. And my brothers are 3 and 4 years older, so they would come back with something quite considered, and I'd be sitting there going, I don't really know what's going on. But there was a period of my life where they stopped giving me pocket money and they invested it in Sock Shop. there was the IPO of Stocksshop in the late 80s in the UK. And my dad announced one day.
Hang on, Stocksshop, did you say? Like they sold socks?
Yeah, there was like, you know, there was Tyrak and there was Stocksshop and there were these really like, I don't know how this was the trend in the 80s, but every supermarket, not supermarket, shopping mall would have these kind of really specific shops. And they'd be like in stations as well, you know, and you just, I don't know, pick up some naughty socks for a gift or I don't know what it was. Anyway.
I'm fascinated your parents saw this as like the hot thing. We must get it all this.
I think everyone did.
I've absolutely invested.
So I remember going to school and explaining to my friends I no longer had pocket money because I was like invested in Stocksshop. I didn't get any pocket money anymore. I couldn't go down to the dairy and get any sweets. It was decided for me. And then at the end, about a year later, my dad gave me £85 and said, you've made a great return on your investment. And that went into my like post office savings account. So I don't know if I learned anything from it, but it's quite funny looking back. But yeah, with my brother, for example, he was like, oh, that's where you earn the money, Rhiannon. And I then diligently went off and I researched every company in the stock exchange and got like a list of all the 200 companies. And he graduated like 3 years before I did because he's 3 years older and he did not know what he was doing. And so then I literally supplied him the list of 200 sort of stock exchange participants because I'd done the research because I was the diligent younger sister. And he wrote to 200 companies. He got two interviews and he got one job.
Wow.
And like, you know, when he wrote letters as well and posted them.
Yeah. What an amazing amount of effort to put into that. Were you watching that? So you were saying he was how much older than you?
3 years.
So were you watching that and feeling a bit nervous? Because that's a huge amount of effort to go through. And you must have been thinking about your own future and wondering if you'd have to do all of that as well.
But the diligence, I think, went through everything, Francis. I have to say, my brother is super clever and you know, he's doing super well with life these days, but he was not an academic boy. Whereas I was really good and I did all my exams and all the rest of it. So I took a completely different path. I applied for one of those summer internships that they used to do. So they would suck up a whole load of interns and they're kind of between their second and third years at university. So I applied to about 8 or 10 of those. And then I was awarded one. And I did that between my second and third years at uni. And then that was 10 weeks long. And at the end of it, they offered about 2 or 3 jobs for graduates next year. And I got one of those jobs. So I actually went into my third year at university with my job all sewn up.
Wow. Good for you. I absolutely did not. I had a minor breakdown in my last year of university and freaked out that I wasn't qualified for anything I actually wanted to do. And so then I did actually, I call that my last year of university. I'd had to do another one to get a postgraduate diploma in something I actually wanted to do. Thank you, journalism. I'm glad that there's some people out there who are actually a little more organized. That gives me a lot of faith.
I think I must be really organized, but yeah, both things work. Both things work. I mean, I think I was sort of learning to kind of go with the flow a bit more and sort of try different things rather than be this kind of rigid person who kind of keeps stepping forward. So yeah, I like to kind of, you know, mess it up a bit more these days.
Well, to be fair though, when I look at it now, and especially when people go to university these days, it's so expensive. And I think there's a lot of advice, at least there was advice that was floating around when I was at high school. I do think people have wised up to it a bit more now, but there was a lot of advice floating around when I was in high school saying, just study something you enjoy and a job will turn up and some company will come and say, who are your smart students and we want to employ them. And that is just absolutely 110% not how it went. Like, I wish. And I think there are a lot of, like, I studied with many people who then found there was absolutely no job for them at the end of it and either ended up in a job, something totally unrelated that they didn't even need a degree for, or they managed to make it kind of work. And I, you know, as I've mentioned, I managed to then just tack another year of study on and end up somewhere where I wanted to. But I studied for twice as long as I needed to for the job I ended up in. And it's expensive. It's tens of thousands of dollars. So as someone who has been in that employer level, I mean, I don't know how much hands-on employing you were doing as CEO of KiwiWealth, but you were, you know, in that upper level of management. A university degree still important, you know, or is it, do we put too much emphasis on them still? Do we need to be more focused on them? This is obviously going to be very personal opinion.
this is very personal. This is really gone wide. I think university degrees are good for is that kind of constant education about how you take on information in the world and how you analyze it and what you do with it. So, I'm very pro education, and therefore I suppose pro tertiary education and university education. I think the subject that you learn is probably not as important. And then, I was listening to Dawn Freshwater the other day, who's the vice chancellor at the University of Auckland. You know, what you do with AI now, I think it's so, I was going to say frightening, but I don't want to be negative about AI. But like, how do you think about...
AI does freak me out. I think you should be cautious.
Yeah, it does freak you out, right? But what information do you know? But I think even more so, you need to then have a mind that is educated. So like, how do you ask good questions and how do you analyze the answers? And therefore, how do you perceive? If you can get all the information at your fingertips, what do you do with it when you have it? And that, I think, is what education's around. And that's, I think, part of the reason why my history degree actually has served me really well in my finance career. Because I sort of, learned how to take information and lots of it and read like streams of like books and information. I really didn't read a book for about 20 years after I left university because I was just, I'd read, in my opinion, far too many, which shows a very poor attitude. But you read so much and then you learn how to analyze it and present arguments, and I used to learn how to present arguments on both sides. I could make an argument pro or against anything really. And I think that's a really useful skill. Obviously you've got to know what you really think at the end, but being able to see things from both sides and take facts and move them around, I think is a skill that is always useful.
I love that.
But for me, if you ask, if I would got to hire people out of university, and I didn't at that CEO level, but because of my background, I think those finance and commerce degrees are amazing. And I think it's really great for the New Zealand economy to come out with that. But a lot of these skills also, I'm still up for the philosophy and the arts and the history and the English as well.
I know. I did a couple of, even anthropology. I really enjoyed my anthropology papers, but I did a couple of philosophy ones as well. And there's still some things that I think about there. So I regret the money spent. I don't necessarily regret the path I ended up on, but it's so expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive. I was lucky. I was the last person last year to go through with no university fees in the UK. So that one shows my age.
Looking great. How's the eye cream? I'll need some recommendations after this. As you started climbing the career ladder, and obviously you did end up hitting CEO, was that a goal you consciously wanted? And at what stage did you think, I might be able to be the leader of a pretty big company?
It was very late stage that I thought I could do that. I would say less than 6 months before I sort of got that role did I think to myself possibly that I could even dream of it. I had a few people around me, but in the previous year going, you could be CEO. And I'm like, no, I couldn't. And it took me till around only a few months before the opportunity came up that I thought, you know what, I would like to do that. And, and therefore that led me to have the courage and audacity to put my hand up and say, yes, I would like to do it. Earlier on in the career, I think around the time that I had my first kid or something around then, I was working at New Zealand Post, and the CEO there was Brian Roach at the time. And I remember that I found out that he started his career in audit. For some reason, that really blew my mind. Like, he just wasn't an auditor anymore. Like, he was the CEO of this huge company, had come through consulting and done all sorts of things. And that was the moment that I thought, like, one, where you start doesn't have to be where you end up. And it was also the moment that I thought, I don't know what I really want to do, but now my next career goal is that, and I'm not there yet, is that when people find out what I do, they're going to be surprised I started in finance. And I wanted to go more general, and I wanted to lead and manage, and I just kind of wanted to go a bit more lateral and see where that took me. But with finance, it's an interesting one. You see a lot of people in finance who stay in finance for an awfully long time. And I feel like there are some people I know in those senior levels who are kind of a bit fed up with it. And I don't think you go into any of these careers to be bored, to kind of churn out and do the same thing over and over again. So that was something that I kind of quite deliberately wanted to avoid. I wanted to try new things and see where they led.
Yeah, tell me more about that, because I think the examples we can see around us are huge. Even from just the small number of examples you've pulled out already, you're obviously getting a lot of men to look up to. It's quite a male-dominated field. But you're still getting people you can look up to and see some examples of what you do want and what you don't want, which is really interesting to me. As you were looking around, tell me more about that. Some of the things you saw that you thought, that looks great. I think I could do that. And I see some of myself in that person, even if they don't look exactly like me. And tell me more about when you saw some things that you're like, don't want that.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, I think as you know, that kind of that moment where you say I could step up to be CEO, I actually think, believe it or not, COVID was really helpful for me in that you know, the way that we changed, you know, our work patterns and we started working from home more. And I know that's a kind of a big subject in itself, but the fact that you could juggle and you didn't have to be in the office 9 to 5 or 8 to 7, and you could take your laptop home and work more hours at home, and you could probably race, and, you know, the whole kind of culture and flexibility about going to watch your kids at athletics or whatever just changed, I think, quite a lot when people realized that you really could log on from home and be productive. And I think that actually did influence, because it was 2020 that I thought, oh, I could potentially be CEO, and towards the end of it. So we'd been through that 6 months of working from home. And I really don't think that I could have gone and been CE if we had to do that kind of classic work style that we'd seen for, you know, a century beforehand, you know, since the industrialized times. So that has really changed. And so I was really conscious when I was CE as well to try and model a style of leadership that I, you know, thought was one good for me, but also good to bring other people in on the journey. So, you know, I did consciously model some of the chaos from the next lockdown. You know, I had kids in the background embarrassing me quite a lot. And I really wanted to, I didn't want to show, but the really embarrassing moments I didn't actually want to happen, but they did. But they really helped other people realize that they could show a bit of themselves as well. And I think that was really important. And I did want to make sure that you could show that you could be a sort of an active parent and do a big job as well. And I think that is something that we're shifting a little bit with these changes in working style, which I think are exciting. And it invites more people in and it brings more people in. And I think it just sort of widens the talent pool, which I think is a really positive thing.
And it is interesting. I want to point out before we get into this topic that I not only would do, but have done, ask men this question as well, because I think it's really important that mums aren't the only parents. But there is also this reality that there's a huge pressure on mums to, most people do have to go to work or want to go to work, whether or not you have to. A lot of people enjoy working and find huge meaning in it. And yet also to be present for your kids, to be part of their lives. I saw a stat the other day that, and this is a proper stat, this is not something I'm just making up, that staying at home mums from the 70s spent as much time with their kids as working mums now, which absolutely speaks to the pressure we put on ourselves, right? That it really was this culture then of you would lock the kids out of the house and say, go and play in the street with the other street children.
Which has got actually really positive elements to it. I'm quite pro them going out. I love the fact my kids now kind of wander up and down the street and find their friends who live nearby. That brings me joy.
I know. I love it. I love being part of this. Is one of the reasons I live in a smaller community these days, that you can actually get to know the people around you. And it's not like kicking your children out to the wolves. It's, you know, everyone knows them. Mine is still too young for that, but I have hope for the future. You know, whereas there's this huge pressure now on working parents of both genders that there is that pressure to be there, to be really present, to be intensively parenting all the time. And I think a lot of us want to have that close relationship with our children too, but combining that with work, hard. So how did you find that in terms of that chief executive role and being a present parent? How much can you have both?
It's hard, you know, Frances. I think it's really, really hard. I did this chief executive role for 2 years and I loved it. And I loved the work and I loved what we did and all the rest of it. But there were moments where you know, and I, you know, I was at home, and in the final year, I think my husband would go to work at 7 a.m. and I would drop the kids and go to work at 9, and then he would pick them up at 3, and I'd come home at 5 or 6, and then we'd both sort of kind of sit on our laptops on the sofas in the evening and sort of catch up and do that sort of thing, which sounds a bit sad, but it wasn't as sad as it sounds.
Yeah, you're describing my life currently.
We also go out, we're quite social, so we'd kind of, that would draw us out, you know, sort of less tragic and so forth. It is hard. I think there were moments where, you know, when the kids, I think when they need more time from you, you know, it's all very well when it's all going swimmingly, but when one of them gets sick or one of them gets anxious about something or they're not getting along with something at school, that becomes really hard. And I did actually feel there was a stage where I almost felt like I was telling the kids, like, you know, come and see me between 6:30 and 7 when I'm free. But until then, can you kind of, you know, can you keep your problems to yourself? And so I think it is a hard, hard thing to juggle. I think having two working parents and a busy family life is really hard. And I watch my friends do it, and it's a lot. I think it's a lot for people to do, especially, as you say, people give a lot more hours to their children and they don't chuck them on the street as much as they used to. It is part of the reason I've gone down this path, right? I'm working, you know, with the CO 101 and with Casterbury and so forth. And I felt that I wanted to sort of work more 9 to 3 for a period of my time. But again, you know, looking at all those incredible working trends, I think you can do that these days in a way that, you know, I don't think you could have done 10 years ago to be working. You know, I sort of move around and I work from home, and I still feel like I can have a really interesting career, but on those terms as well. So I gave a lot of thought when I left Kiwi Wealth as to, you know, what are those trends that I see? You know, I suppose I'm used to analysing trends. How can I apply them to my life to kind of create the balance that I want to see, and the kind of spending time with the kids and doing interesting work?
Yeah, tell me more about that, because when it started to percolate in your head of maybe I want to do something a little bit different, you know, you're CEO of a big existing company, there's probably only so you can set the culture a certain amount as CEO, but you're still not, you know, a fairy. You're not able to wave a magic wand and just say everything's different now. You know, you still answering to people. There's still certain things you have to do. Whereas when you're setting up your own business, there is still business realities, but there is a certain amount more flexibility where you can say, I am designing this business for the lifestyle I want. So how did that start to sort of filter through your head? What did you start to think you could do in order to have that hallowed work-life balance?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, yeah, is there any perfect answer? No, but I thought to myself, right, I've rather enjoyed the autonomy of being CE. I've also watched a lot of my friends set up businesses, and I've always thought that grass looks really green, always been intrigued. You know, I've been on my, you know, corporate career, which I've got a lot out of, but I thought no one's really failing here, or not from my perspective. I'm sure it's extremely hard. Having thought I'd like to do that, I thought, if not now, when? You know, I'm sort of, by this point, I was in my early-ish 40s, and, you know, I left Kiwi Wealth after it was bought by Fisher Funds. And so I was made redundant in that process. I probably could have, you know, asked to stay in different ways, shape or form, but I didn't want to, because I knew that the business was going to go down another path. So I had a little bit of a financial cushion. I thought, if not now, when? Let's give it a go. And I've really enjoyed that in the hours. And, you know, the other thing that I'm trying to do over the very long term, you know, with a 10-year time horizon, is build something that allows me to spend July and August in the UK each year, because that's where I'm from. I don't want to move back there. But if I can do those summer months in London and avoid Wellington, where I live, in July and August, I mean, that would be the ultimate lifestyle in my view. So that's what I'm trying to build. It is hard, though, because running around those school hours, the reality is, you know, what I'm learning is that any business or anything to go well, you have to put an enormous amount of heart, soul and hours in. You know, I go through periods where I feel I'm really crushing it. And then, you know, I've just come out of 2 weeks of school holidays. And then I was very fortunate to celebrate a friend's birthday overseas as well. It was a big one. And I've come back, and by the end of last week, I was really anxious. I was like, I haven't spent enough time on this, and it's not, you know, how is it working? It needs more time from me. So yeah, I'm still very much learning how to do it.
Yeah, I love that moment where you're like, woohoo, I'm crushing it. Oh no, now I'm getting crushed.
And then it goes all the time. It's all the time. And you're like, I actually, at one point, if about 2 months ago, I had to start taking a notebook. And, you know, every time I had something went right, I had to start writing it in so that when I kind of, the next moment where I felt like I was under a rock, I could bring it out and read it back to myself and be like, no, you're getting there.
I think something else that came through to me there when you were saying about that was, again, the looking around and seeing other people and seeing the examples of other people around you. That's another reason why I love doing interviews like this, is having conversations with people from all different walks of life. I think when we can see other people doing things, it makes it more real to us. It makes it more of a possibility. And you say, oh, they have a different situation there. I don't think I could do that. But that bit I could totally steal for myself. So you're seeing these people around you, your friends, start businesses. How important was that in terms of the inspiration? Yes, but did you go and talk to any of them about the reality of business life and what might help you get started? Or was it just sort of watching from afar and thinking, oh, I could do that?
I probably didn't ask enough about real business life before I went down the path.
Or is it good to not know sometimes?
But you look like you're going fine. Oh, you're stressed now. You look fine. You're having a lovely life. It's a bit like any kind of club. You know, I've got, you know, I talked the other day about the CEO's club and people will take take your cool and your coffee. I felt like when I announced I was having my third child, everyone who had more than two children kind of welcomed me into their secret. You've got your ratios wrong in parenting club. And this one as well, I felt like everyone who really ran their own business did come and have coffee in with me. And they were just really excited to see someone else join their ranks and see how it would go. But super encouraging. And it's taught me so much about supporting other people's businesses as well in a way that I'd never thought about. When you're in a corporate, you just kind of choose your things. And now I'm like, wow, you guys are out doing it by yourself or two or three. And now I'm much more conscious about supporting people's smaller endeavors than I ever was. Because you know, like, how hard that can be. But yeah, did I learn enough from other people? I mean, my husband kind of looked at me. He kind of runs a relatively small business. He's in a partnership with two other people, and they've grown from three of them to about 15. And he looked at me and was like, what are you doing? You're like, you don't really understand how difficult this is. And I think he really likes, you know, he thinks I'm really good in corporate and, you know, it's a nice, safe salary as well. So he was like, you know, supportive, but sort of one eyebrow raised. Yeah, I've learned an awful lot and I'm still learning an awful lot as I go. But this is what I love. You know, it's just so interesting to go down that other path, as I said, to, you know, I'm always sort of trying to shake it up a little bit and try and learn something new so that, you know, you'd never want your life to be dull.
I've got to say, I want to jump into some lessons that we can take for all of us from your wide and varied history, because I find this a lot, and I'd love to know if people assume this for you too, given your history. So many people will message me, and my whole thing, right, is answering people's questions or finding someone who can. So people send me their questions, but they often have this whole preamble first, where they're obviously very worried I'm going to judge them, which for starters, not my thing at all. But secondly, they're assuming my finances are perfect. Very much not the case. I'm so far from perfect. I've done well for myself, given the things that I know, don't get me wrong. But do I mess up all the time? And I also, you know, I've talked to so many financial advisors as well. Some people who work in finance have some of the worst personal situations I've ever seen, where they tell you something in passing. And again, not judging, but I'm also like, you just gave me some anxiety on your behalf. Are you all right? So is there anything, a money mistake that you look back on for yourself and you cringe a little?
Again, as you say, so many. I mean, my finances, I like to also say, like, I'm not the fund manager. So, you know, maybe, you know, I just ended up as a manager of a finance business. But I did come through finance. The worst thing that I did recently was I didn't contribute to my KiwiSaver in the last year, because I'd set up my own business and I sort of took some drawings and this, that, and the other, but I still don't really understand the accounting side of my small business. And I made no contribution to my own KiwiSaver. And don't forget, I was a KiwiSaver CEO for an entire KiwiSaver year. And so, like, you get that government contribution. You literally have to put in about $550, and I could afford to put that in, but I just kind of forgot. And, you know, I got various emails from my KiwiSaver provider, but, you know, I couldn't remember my login. I was like, who do I send the money to? Is it to the IRD? I'm like, I don't know. And then by the time I logged in and did it, it was over. And I was like, wow, I just missed my free $500. And, you know, and also having not contributed for a year, that's also disgusting. But I'd like to say I put a massive whack in just before the previous financial year. So I feel it's sort of okay-ish, but missing out on the free money when that's all we've been telling people to do for years and years feels really rotten. But I've had all the credit card debts in the past as well. I've racked them up. I've got new cards on interest-free and then moved them around. And, you know, that is not good finance. And getting out of those holes is really, really hard. You know, I've done all sorts of things where I just haven't negotiated well going into jobs. And I've kind of thrown away kind of almost money in terms of how I've negotiated things because I just haven't had the eye on the detail. And I've got better with that over the years. And some people would probably say I'm quite ruthless now with my REM negotiations. So that's probably something I learned. But, you know, I mean, it took me a long time to put myself into a growth fund. I knew I was supposed to be in it, but it all sounded, and I knew, I mean, I really know about funds, but it still sounded a bit risky and scary. So it was only when we got our robo-advice tool going and I went through and it was like, you're meant to be in growth. I was like, okay, like I know, I've known. And I eventually actually switched it. But those sorts of things are, you know what you're supposed to do, but you just don't apply it. You're right. We, you know, and you see that in all sorts of professions, I think, not just finance.
Oh my God. They're not doing something for literal months because of the login issue. I very, unfortunately, strongly identify with that. If it ever slips off my password manager, I'm like, well, don't know. It could be five different variations of this number one password I use, or it could be the six variations of the super strength other password that I use. And I'm just going, I'll come back to that. And then you don't, because life is really busy. You mentioned the career misstep as well. I want to dive into that too, because yeah, the learning, taking the courage to be, as you say, ruthless with those negotiations. Important, I think. Hard to do when you're younger, and often a skill that does develop over time. What sort of things are you ruthless on now, or do you advise people to be ruthless on when it comes to those negotiations and the career steps?
Yeah, I think, you know, in that moment, I think, to be honest, if you've been given a job offer, you almost always should go back and negotiate because this is your one moment.
I think they expect you to.
Yeah, I think it's almost rude not to.
They start off with a low ball, right? Because they expect you to.
They do. And like, you don't want to be, I also think that sometimes I look back and I wonder if I was too brassy about some of them. I've definitely burnt a bridge or two by maybe going too hard. I don't think I regret it, but I'm in the gray zone. But I think, you know, going back and asking something, I think politely, explaining why you think you might be worth more using kind of, you know, facts, as you say, you're using a real fact earlier, like saying, well, this is what people get paid in my industry, and this is what I believe I'm worth, and this is my experience. So if you can get that data, I think that really helps. You want a dispassionate kind of email back or something that says, actually, these are the three or four bullet points that I think is why I'm worth $2,000 more a year or $5,000 or whatever it might be. And if you can't get that, then you can negotiate on those softer things, like, can I have a couple more days leave? For example, that's kind of like a free, you know, it's kind of a free pay rise to a certain extent. And there are other bits and pieces you can do around that. But I think that moment as they really want you and you're going in, I think is one of the moments that you've got the most negotiating power. And it's so much, so different once you're in the organization to try and persuade them that you're sort of worth that. But I do think a lot of companies these days are much better about that kind of pay parity and making sure that they're giving pay rises to people because they're worth it, not just because they asked, because you get that, otherwise you do get that disparity sometimes between the genders about people who ask for more and therefore get it as opposed to the people who don't. And so I think there's been quite a lot of people, you know, our company definitely went through and looked at everyone at the same level and tried to make sure that people who were doing the same work were getting paid the same amount. And that was something I think we did achieve.
Yeah. And when you say about some of the burned bridges, talk to me about that, because I think that's a lot of people's fear, right? that they don't want to even start the conversation, don't want to even start the negotiation because they're scared of the job offer being pulled back or starting off on a wrong foot. Let's dive into a bit more. You know, you said, you know, do your research and get into that sort of thing. How do you approach it in terms of, I would like more, let's have a conversation, but we're keeping this all really sweet because then I'm going to have to work alongside you, hopefully.
Yeah, I think back to, yeah, it's a good question. I think maybe I dug my heels in a bit much on the one that I did. And so that's why I kind of look back at it. I think, you know, lost something in that particular relationship. But that was, you know, to be a little bit explicit, it was with the board of directors and a particular director who was, so I sort of lost one out of five bosses probably rather than one out of one, but still not ideal, not something that I really relish. I think going back to making it not a personal thing, it's a negotiation. Work is work. This is business. This is commerce. And so if they want your talent and your time, I think it's just, if you're going back and saying, thank you for this, but you know, you offered me $80,000, but actually most people in my experience get 85 and these are the reasons why. It's just, I think the manner in which you do it, I think is quite important. And not to be righteous and not to be, maybe I got too kind of confrontational in that interaction and sort of to my way or the highway. And I think that's probably where I may have gone wrong, or maybe I went right because I got the sort of answer that I wanted to. And I did have data to back me up. But I think the data to do it, you know, in a really kind of polite way at the beginning and not to go too hard, I think is probably the way to do it. But yeah, don't ask, don't get. Going back to, yeah, one of the things I used to use quite a lot, you know, we talked about my brother at the very beginning, and I'm sorry to bring him up again, but he often used to say to me when I went into negotiations, I would call him up, you know, still thinking about the sunshine and where it comes out of. And I'd be like, ask him his opinion. And he would kind of, you know, he'd give it to me in that kind of actually slightly more male way, be so much more aggressive about it. And then I'd try and pick up some of her energy. But he'd also say like, Rhiannon, you are the real deal. You know, you deserve this. And that would like, you know, boy me. And I was like, even though it's just your brother, right? I was like, you know, he thinks I deserve it.
I love your brother. He sounds great.
Oh, he's got his...
I'm starting to see the sunshine effect here.
Honestly, he doesn't deserve it. But yeah, so, but it's useful. Like, if you, but to know that there's somebody, but your husband or your friend or whoever it is, you think you're brilliant, go to them. Go to them before you get that and fill your cup so that you don't feel like that you're sort of asking for one you don't deserve it. Go and talk to the people who think you're brilliant. And then when you go in, you can have your head... I always never sit properly anyway, but like, you know... Feel like you deserve it when you go in and say it with a big smile and say, hey, this is what I deserve. I know that I'm worth this. And it's really hard to feel like that yourself. And I struggle with it. And I think everyone struggles with it. So go find the people who believe in you and let them talk to you first and big you up.
Yeah, 100%. There's two things there that I think were such good points. When you say, you know, it's how you say it. And I say this all the time, not just in the business life, but in the personal life as well. You can say the exact same words in a different tone and it will be taken very differently.
Yes, you're right.
It's so important. I mean, you can also slightly change up your phrasing and have the same meaning. But, you know, if you're going to someone saying, no, you need to pay me more, how dare you? That's obviously not going to go so well. But if you say, thank you so much, this sounds like a great offer. I'm really excited about coming to work with you. I have looked around and checked other job listings, talked to other people in the industry, and I feel like the rate is more around this sort of range. How do you feel and how we can hit that? And then I'd be so excited to come on board, which is, you know, classic shit sandwich happening right there. You know, you have something positive at the beginning, positive at the end, ask in the middle, and then I feel like that goes quite well. And then, as you're saying, you know, to talk to people who believe in you, because flip it around the other way. So many of us will tell our friends, family, loved ones, you can do it. You've got it. Go for it. Love this for you. And then when it comes to advocating for ourselves, so much harder. We make every excuse for why it's different for us and we can't negotiate that hard or we're not worth as much. And I'll just accept what they've given me. And you would never give that advice to your friend. So flip it around and let your friends buoy you up this time and help you do that. You know, there's so much in the finance, career, everything space where if you use community to help you, it's always so important, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, your support networks are so important in every way. I mean, I went for that CEO job, for example. I was thinking about, you know, the potential opportunity, and I was umming and ahhing. So I kind of got to the stage, I was like, oh, I think I want the job. And then I thought the job was sort of, you know, somewhat within reach, but I still wasn't sure. So I was thinking about it and I was umming and ahhing. And I was like, oh, you know what? I don't think I will go for that job because it's, you know, I've got, you know, my three children at home. And at the time, you know, my mother-in-law was super sick and all the things, like, it's too much. And so I was like, I think it worked. And I spoke to a friend about it, and she was like, what are you talking about? You have to go for this job. And I was like, oh, you know. She goes, we will back you up. If you get this job, we will be there. And I was like, oh, okay. So I did. This is the friend who I actually went on this sort of big birthday with last week. And
sounds like a good mate.
And she did. Like, honestly, like, afterwards, I got the job. Things were absolutely chaotic and mayhem. And one evening, she came around and she put my children to bed for me.
Isn't that amazing? I often talk to people about how important the mum tribe is. I don't know how you get through motherhood without it. You need at the very least one other mum friend who's in the trenches there with you. But if you can find a few, awesome. This is not a this is not a situation to go through alone, is it?
I mean, it is the trenches. I remember a friend of mine before I had kids was like, I'm in the trenches. And I was like, this is a weird kind of warfare type term. But then I went into it myself.
And then you get in the trenches and you're like, oh yeah, it's warfare.
Yeah, you do need people. I mean, the whole, like, it takes a village, it's just so true. You can't do it alone. You know, I think, to a certain extent, we've all been taught we can do everything ourselves these days. And I love that kind of mentality. But actually, when you become a mother, and it's funny what our sort of finance talk is talking about, but, like, you begin to realize you can't do everything alone. And you actually do need to rely on lots of other people. And the bigger your support network, the better. I remember actually the first, I think, call I did with the board, and I think I had just accepted the acting CEO offer. I got a message and it discovered that our after-school nanny had gone to Christchurch, and my child, my 5 or 6 year old, was just, you know, in the garden, and I had no way of getting to her. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I was like, I'm just going to jump off the call for a second. And I had to go and then call a friend who lives up the street, and, like, you know, Madeline, who would have been like, I don't know, 6 or 7, is like in the garden alone. Can you please go and get her? He's just like, what a fail. I'm like, you know, thank goodness for these people. So I quite like actually being 9 to 3 at the moment, because I'm beginning to kind of pay back some of those favors, because I took so many of them. So, yeah, it's nice to feel like you can kind of contribute back in a little bit as well now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big believer that over the course of years, relationships in your life should be 50-50. But it's a little bit like investing, right? Some years might be more. Some years might be less. Because at some seasons in life, your friends will need more and can't give as much. In other seasons of life, you might need more support and not be able to give as much. And hopefully it all balances out.
I hope so.
You have those seasons where you're giving more and you're getting less, and the other way around. When you did start this business, I think it's such an interesting business idea. First of all, tell me about the business you have now that is hopefully giving you a little bit more of this balance.
Yeah. So I've got, I sort of started kind of 1.5 businesses. One of them is called CEO 101.
1.5.
Well, it's sort of like, I think I've got the business structures correct. But anyway, 1.5, got 2 websites, 1 business underneath it. So one of them is CEO 101, and it emerged out of Casabri, which is a sort of strategic consulting and advice business aimed at CEs, particularly new ones, but also established, to give them advice and to sort of help them through. And knowing that, you know, lots of people have too much on. And so trying to say, look, here's some senior support who can help you almost in a fractional way, or whether it be strategic consulting advice and so forth. But as I was sort of, you know, working on that business, I sort of thought, what would be really helpful, particularly with those new CEs that I'm coaching and trying to help, is to have all this sort of digital material that I can say, go and read this article or that one. I think these are really helpful. And the more I thought about it, I thought, right, this would make a great online course. And I started to structure a curriculum about what I thought would be really useful for that moment where, if you're thinking about stepping up to CEO, you've just done it, or a refresher, what you really need to get your head around in those kind of quite heady moments when you first start. Because I remember starting very vividly. I remember the butterflies in my stomach every day for 2 weeks, where I'd wake up feeling quite unusual. and not really knowing where to turn and no real resources or courses that didn't involve maybe stepping out of the office for a week and going and sort of going kumbaya down in Queenstown, which I didn't want. I wanted to, you know, I needed to be on the tools and redoing the strategy and the vision, the communications and everything. So that course is, you know, has 6 modules and it goes through, you know, why, you know, setting yourself up for success and then getting the right people around you, which I really believe in. And then getting your strategy and your risk. I think it's governance, stakeholders, and then managing your team. But then the next course that I'm writing at the moment is really about bringing anyone up into that leadership journey, because I really feel that, you know, we need more leaders from more diverse backgrounds. You know, those stories we talked about earlier, like seeing people and thinking, I can do that too. And I think, you know, some of the stories that I can share, some of the tips that I can share, I think is really, hopefully will be really beneficial and kind of really goes to, you know, my purpose and sort of heart about trying to make sure there is more diversity in leadership and that people feel that they can see these people, that they can step up, that they can be a part of it. So by sharing tips, sharing stories, I'm hoping that's going to work. So that's all at CEO 101. And, you know, I hope people will find it helpful.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's so important. What would be one of the big underrated skills that you think people don't realize has a big impact on this trajectory, especially if you're heading for the top?
Yeah, I think actually you almost touched on it earlier about tone, right? I think empathy and getting on with others is so important. And we talk about soft skills a lot these days, but these ones are free. You know, you don't have to go off and like, yes, please do buy my course and, you know, learn all sorts of things. But like learning how to get along with other people, you know, is really something that you don't need to get, you know, it's not a hard technical skill that you need to go to LinkedIn Learning for. You know, guessing like how you say things and how you interact with people, how you make people feel. I think those are the really kind of important bits of leadership. And you don't have to wait to be given that opportunity either. Like management's a little bit different because someone's got to appoint you to be a manager, but you can be a leader in any position because you just have to choose to sort of take on those roles yourself and show other people the way. And perhaps even just believe that, you know, by working together, a team of people working together in the same direction, it's more powerful than one individual, which I, you know, really quite deeply believe. But yeah, empathy. And the other really easy one for me, because I talk a lot, is listening. And, you know, there's probably half of us out there are extroverts. You know, listening so that you can learn from other people, as you talked about the stories and you're getting inspiration from others. It's a really cheap and easy way of, you know, finding all sorts of information. And if you want to be Machiavellian about it, you know, it's so that you can actually understand their position so you can influence them and say, okay, I understand where you're coming from. This is what I want to tell you too. And you can't do that if you're talking over somebody. You've got to stop and listen.
Ooh, I think that's such an underrated one there. You're absolutely right on that. You might have, you know, the leadership that where you're trying to tell people what to do. Fine, that's an element of leadership. But there's also, you need to know what's going on. You need to be able to take that feedback from people. Otherwise, your strategies aren't going to be much good if they're not actually relating to what people are actually going through in their work. And also, as you say, when you get to know people, you understand them, you understand their motivators, you are going to be so much better at delivering those messages in a way that people are ready to listen to. I mean, we're pretty much out of time on this. If there is one tip that people who are ambitious, aiming for the top areas of their career, aiming to make the most of it, if there's one tip only that you could give them, what would that be?
Value the people around you. It's not just about you. It's about all the people around you that make you successful, that make the organization that you work for successful, that make your family and your community successful. So, you know, I think one of the things that I think is so important is if you begin to see the people around you is as important as the person that you are. I think that's really, really important. And not to kind of say that you should put yourself, you know, at the bottom of the pile and the bottom of the pack the whole time. And I know that, you know, lots of people can do that a little bit. But, you know, you kind of, if you have the people around you, you've got incredible teams at work, that you don't put up with having horrible people around you, that you kind of get rid of those people and say, you know what, I don't want to spend time with you, and you suck my energy down. You know, I think there's one of those phrases like, you know, you're kind of that sum of the five people that you spend the most time with.
Which is so true.
Yeah, do you think it's true? I think it probably is. So make sure those five people are people you value and think are really contributing positively. But, you know, and that sort of career and that team aspect is not something you can do alone. And there is one of those phrases, isn't there? Like, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together.
I like that. That one I hadn't come across. I really, really like that. That's such a good one.
Yeah, it is good, isn't it? And it is. Sometimes it feels easier, like, just to not get the feedback to go faster. That's going to slow me down. I'm going to have to incorporate that. And, you know, and I felt like when I was, you know, seeing and all the other times, like opening up my like precious piece of work to feedback, it still kills me to this day. Like, oh, it's so like, I don't want to be told it's not right and it's not perfect and I want it to be perfect. But it is always better when I share it and someone else contributes their expertise and says, actually, this would make it better. And there's never a time it hasn't ended up better. But I always have to get over that hump.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an enduring life skill, right? Is being able to put the ego aside and just take that feedback for what you can, because there is always, I don't care who you are, there's always room for improvement. Man, it's hard to hear what needs to improve. I don't like it.
I hate it.
But I do need it.
Yeah, you do need it. I was saying to a friend the other day who was being given feedback that he didn't like, and I was like, feedback is a gift. It's a gift. And actually, when you get really senior, it's really hard to get hold of good, honest feedback. People get a bit sycophantic and everyone's going, no, you're doing a great job. And you're like, I'm sure I could be better. So take that feedback and use it.
And actually, I mean, we'll get to soon where people can find you, because I think a lot of people will want to track you down. But you've actually really triggered a memory for me there. And I'm just going to, so quick before we wrap this up, because my mum, I love her so much. She is hilarious, and that I can always rely on her to really give me honest feedback. She's diplomatic. She's not a dick. I have to say that because she sometimes listens. But she gives her honest feedback in a way that she feels like is as diplomatic as she can, but she definitely doesn't sugarcoat. And when I first started this new podcast, she listened like a good mum, and we met up. We went for a little walk and had a coffee together. And I said, oh, you know, I'm really excited for it. I can do it exactly how I want it to be. And I'm really excited by, I've changed the structure of how I edit the episodes together. And it's got this new opening sequence that I really like. What do you think of it? And she went, well, only because you brought it up. Oh, I hated that, actually.
I like it, but you need it. You need that feedback. I hope you told her she wasn't your target market.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I did. She was like, oh, you don't need to worry about changing it just for me. And I was like, don't worry, Mum, I have no intention of changing it. I thought about it long and hard before I did it, but I love that you told me you went into it. I actually truly mean it. I'm confident in what I'm doing. If I heard that from like 10 people, I probably would think about changing it. But I am confident enough in what I'm doing that I can take feedback on and go, that's one person's opinion, I'm going to shelve it. But I still value getting that opinion. Do you know what I mean? Because I can then hear, if I get that feedback from more people and say, ooh, maybe I am wrong. Maybe I didn't consider this right. And I just love being surrounded by someone who'll say, I know that you're telling me that you're really excited about that. Not for me, but yay for you. Truly, I value that so much.
That's like mums are born. Yeah, my mum was brutal in her feedback the whole way through. Just, you know, and like, yeah, well done, dear. But what's the next step? There was a lot of like, you know, what's going to be next? You know, there was no resting on my laurels at any time. So, you know, just keep striving forward.
God bless mums.
But she's fantastic. She's so good. She gives such, yeah. And it's honest and, you know, it's never, yeah, she doesn't white lie to me, but that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love that. Aspire to be that type of mum when the day comes. All right. If people want to keep an eye on your journey and what you're offering, of course, all your services, where can they find you?
Easiest to go to the website. It's ceo101.nz. So it's pretty easy to remember, I hope. So just, you know, if you're just thinking about how you start out as, you know, towards your journey to senior leadership, it's just the 101 course and .nz because it's for New Zealanders.
Love it. Thank you so much. That's Rhiannon McKinnon. And if you have any questions for me about this or anything else to do with money, come and talk to me about it. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Frances Cook NZ. But honestly, if you want to make sure social media algorithms don't stop us from talking to each other, there's also my newsletter where you'll get a free money tip or trick in your inbox every single week. And you can sign up to that on my website, francescook.co.nz. Don't forget to subscribe to Making Sense everywhere you find podcasts. And until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.